That's the drone that means this is a brand new episode of our Fun Kids Science Weekly podcast. My name's Dan, thank you so much for giving us a listen. This is the show where we take a sneak peek and try and solve all the secrets that are lurking out there in the universe. Now this week we chat about the bizarre brain disease that sends people to sleep and sometimes they never wake up. Also, we chat about all the ways that humans are really quite similar to animals. We talk to a genius about that, a guy called Christopher Lloyd, and it's all about a brand new book that he's written, which takes you through all of the amazing animals that are out there and how similar they are to us humans. And I got some of your questions to answer. Today they're about light bulbs and rockets. We'll crack through those after we catch up with one of our favourite experts on the show. This is Sir Sidney McSprocket, and he's telling us how things that we use every single day are made.
How's it made?
Oh, hello. Sir Sidney McSprocket here. I've been in action capturing facts all about manufacturing. It's for this rather splendid stipendiary compendium I'm compiling. You just ask it how something is made, and it'll oblige with a fulsome explanation. Now, something that gets a lot of people a bit excited is slime. Not sure why myself. Slime's better off left in ponds, if you ask me. But it's a fun substance to play with. But how is slime made? Slime is made from mixing a number of chemical ingredients. A bit like mixing together ingredients to make a cake.
Step one.
The chemicals are mixed in large stainless steel tanks, and computers instruct hoppers to pour in just the right amounts of each ingredient.
Step two.
One of the chemicals is a polymer-based substance, not unlike the white glue you use at school. Polymer molecules are long chains which will give the slime its slippery feel.
Step three.
A gelling agent goes in too, often something called sodium borate. This will make the slime sticky. Water is also added to get the slime to just the right consistency.
Step four.
Other ingredients include fragrance and colour. And to keep everyone safe, preservatives are added to prevent the slime from getting all rotten and germy. The ingredients are then mixed to create the right consistency of slime.
Step five.
Jars which hold the slime are loaded onto a conveyor belt that lines them up underneath nozzles, which will squirt the right amount of slime into each.
Step six.
And then a lid is added, and off the jars go to be boxed up. Of course, you needn't buy slime from a shop. It's a very simple recipe, and one you can make at home. Just add white school glue to some liquid detergent. Oh, but get an adult to help. Adults aren't always big fans of slime, where it's not expected. Now, I must get on, but come back soon and find out more about manufacturing with my splendid stipendiary compendium.
How's it made? With support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition. Find out more at funkidslive.com.
It's time for my favourite part of the show, of the week actually. It's when I spend my time researching the answers to the questions that you've left me over on the Apple Podcast Store. I become like this weird, science-y Sherlock. I kind of tap into a part of my brain that never really exists until this one moment every week. Lily is first. She's 8 years old, and she asks, how do light bulbs turn on simply by a switch? Well, Lily, light is an energy which can be released by an atom in particles called photons. Now, they release these photons when the electrons around the atom get excited. And inside a light bulb, you've got a small metal filament, a tiny piece of metal, usually it's tungsten, and it's coiled around in a spring. The filament is also got argon in it, which is a gas. Now, when electricity flows through the filament, Its energy vibrates all the atoms that are in the gas and it heats them up. This causes the atoms to release the photons which give us the light. Now, the filament is part of a circuit, and when you flick your light switch off, it breaks the circuit. It takes two pieces that were touching and means they don't touch anymore. The circle isn't complete, so the electricity can't get to the bulb. And when you turn the light switch on again, it completes the circuit, letting the electricity get to the bulb, to the filament, exciting the electrons, releasing the photons, giving us light. Thanks for the question. Onwards. That was quite a long one. I didn't expect it to be. This is from Imogen, who asks, why do rockets not break when they escape the Earth's atmosphere? Well, Imogen, they kind of do. Now, it's not because of damage, but they break apart because they're too heavy. They're meant to break apart. You see, it uses a huge amount of fuel and propellant to get the rocket into space. Most of what you see when you look at a long rocket, when you picture one in your mind, is just a place to store fuel. Now, as it gets to space, the rocket needs to be lighter to fight the gravity that's trying to pull it back. So it drops off kind of the bottom two-thirds of the rocket, the long bit. And they will just either float around space or it will fall back and it will drop into the Earth. Usually it goes into the ocean. Only the very top of the rocket, the real point at the very top, that's what makes it to where it needs to go. And that doesn't break apart. Thank you so much for the question, Imogen. If you've got something science-y that you want answered on this show, you need to find the Fun Kid Science Weekly on the Apple Podcast Store. Give us a review and leave it in the comment box at the bottom. It's the Fun Kid Science Weekly. Now, how about this? Humans are much more like animals than we ever thought. I'm not just talking about how they work inside their body and how they breathe and how they eat, but also in how they act, what they do, and how they process the world around them. Now, the new book, Humanimal, takes us through all of this, and the author, Christopher Lloyd, is on the show now to tell us more. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for joining us. I thought we'd start, if we can, with something quite surprising. What do you think is the most surprising way that some animals are most like us humans?
Well, you know, I've found all sorts of amazing and surprising ways they're like humans when I was researching this book, but probably the most spectacular and the thing that's most topical, perhaps, is the way that beehives and the bees in the hives make their decisions. So they have a form of democracy, would you believe it? They vote. And, you know, you might think something like voting and democracy is the most sophisticated decision-making, you know, culture that's unique to humans. But guess what? It's been happening for hundreds of millions of years in the world of bees. So when they want to relocate their hive the next year, they send out a few scout bees to find different places within a mile or so that they think is a good place to relocate. These bees then come back to the nest and they do a waggle dance, which reveal the coordinates of the place that they have found that they think is a good place for the hive to relocate. The other bees then go and scout out these other places, come back to the hive, and then they dance next to the bee that they think has made the right decision. Then after about 2 or 3 weeks, the bee that has the most other bees dancing with it is the one that wins, and that's where they relocate their hive. You know, and when I read about this, when I discovered about this and talked to the researchers and so on, I was just gobsmacked that here we are, you know, in a sophisticated world trying to work out, you know, what to do with Europe and how we choose our leaders, you know, using democracy, the most advanced form of decision making. And there it is happening. It's called range voting in the world of bees, and it's been like that for millions of years.
What really smacks my gob about that, Chris, is how researchers and scientists know this. How do they possibly understand the waggle dance that a bee is doing to pinpoint precise coordinates?
Well, I know it is stunning, isn't it? I mean, I guess what it is, it's about just watching, isn't it? You know, and so many of these amazing experts, I suppose the person who really set the whole thing off of just saying, look, I am going to immerse myself in animal culture and the animal world was Jane Goodall, who, of course, is still with us. But she started off researching chimpanzees in Tanzania, and she literally lived with them for months at a time. And so much so that, you know, she became aware, I think, of their culture in ways that you couldn't just do in a laboratory. And it's the same, you know, with the people who were studying the bees. And they simply spent, you know, hours and hours. Carl von Frisch, and he had his research student, Martin Lindauer, who is from Germany. And they just, you know, they watched, they analyzed, they logged, they recorded, and then they got all this data. And, of course, out of the data, there's a story. And then that's the story that emerged.
You mentioned chimpanzees. You also use those in the books to highlight how animals can be as self-aware as humans. That's what really blows my mind when you think about how different we are to other creatures in the wild. It's that it seems that we have a greater understanding of who we are, why we are here, what we're doing, and maybe our own flaws or triumphs. Can you just talk to us about how some animals show these things as well?
Well, yes. I mean, this is a test that was developed some time ago called the self-awareness test. And of course, if you're looking in the mirror, if I show a mirror to a child, when I'm giving one of my lectures or talks, I say, "What do you see?" Of course, first thing they see is they see me. But actually, to say me is quite sophisticated, because you need to have a sense of self, and you have to know that that is actually you and not some other creature looking at, you know, in this panel. And for a long time, scientists thought, well, this advanced sense of awareness must be unique to humans, the idea of me and self. But since then, quite a few animals have passed what's called the mirror test. It's quite simple, really. They put a little cross on an animal's head, and then they put the animal in front of a giant mirror. And the test is, does the animal reach out to the mirror and scratch the cross or whatever, thinking it's another creature, or does it actually reach up to its own face and scratch the cross, knowing that what it sees in the mirror is itself? And so elephants and chimpanzees and dolphins and quite a few different creatures, I have to say mostly mammals, but also there's some evidence that birds and insects can pass the mirror test. So this sense of awareness, of consciousness, that it's me existing in this universe and engaging, you know, and I have this sort of sense of who I am, is something definitely not unique to humans.
It's such an amazingly simple test. How much do we understand, Christopher, about what it is that's similar inside all of our brains that's helping us be self-conscious?
Well, you see, again, another fascinating thing, because, of course, if you think about the story of evolution, you know, humans are a product or one journey through, you know, 4 billion years of the evolution of DNA, the code that's in all our genes, you know. And when they did the Human Genome Project to decode our genes, you know, they found out that we're 99.5, 99% the same, our DNA as chimpanzees. When they, you know, our ancestors originally were fish, you know, they came out of the sea and they learned to sort of do press-ups so they could have ankles and wrists and so on, so they could survive on the land and learn to breathe the air. And they adapted, of course, but we're basically fish that have adapted to living on the land. So that when scientists have discovered the nerve endings in fish are identical to the nerve endings in humans, it shouldn't come as a great big surprise. So they've started doing drugs trials on fish, and if a fish has a panic attack and you give it a kind of anti-panic drug, it seems to have the same effect in fish as it has on humans. And of course, many of the drugs testings that happens, in scientific laboratories, and a whole different issue on the ethics of this, of course, but they're being tested on mice and on different types of creatures as a precursor to seeing, you know, what the effect is on humans. And why would they do that if these mice and these other creatures didn't have very, very similar nervous systems and feelings to human beings?
It's not just the... Well, let's talk more about the feelings then, because it's not just being self-aware.
Yep.
As humans, we have many, many emotions, from joy and happiness to grief and sadness, to envy, to aggression. Christopher, can you take us through some examples in the animal kingdom of how creatures show these emotions as well?
Yes, absolutely. And they do, all over the place. The more you look, the more you see it. So, you know, I've got some wonderful videos. In fact, any of your listeners can go online and search in Google and try and find these things themselves. But some, you know, one of the theories as to why giraffes have such big long necks is because the males will have tremendously aggressive contests, usually about, you know, who's going to be the one to sort of mate with the females. And they do this by having these, you know, battles with their giant long necks with each other, where they clearly, the aggression, you know, is something that is coursing through their veins, just as it does with human beings. There's a wonderful example of an octopus. And octopuses get angry when they're approached or threatened, just like humans do, and they puff up to twice their size and turn bright red. Well, it's almost exactly the same as human beings. Have you? When's the last time you saw someone's face turn red with anger? You know, we've all seen this in the human world, and there it is happening in the world of octopuses. If you've seen anybody who lives with pets, I think, has an instinctive understanding that these are creatures with feelings like ours. For years, scientists said we are what they call anthropomorphizing. We're projecting our feelings onto other creatures. But in a way, I see that as a continuation of a religious tradition to say that humans are special and different, and other creatures are just there for our, you know, convenience or whatever. But actually, you know, cats get enormously cross and angry again, and they can lash out, and they can and dogs can get depressed if you leave a dog alone. I mean, I live with dogs. And I'm sure many of your listeners will sympathize with this, and they can exhibit this very similar, if not identical, feelings to us human beings. And I think understanding these similarities creates an empathy between humans and other living creatures that's really important for young people to feel, to help us navigate the future in a way that's better for all living things, which is really why I call the humanimal, because I thought, let's look at the language. Let's not look at the differences and call species all different things. Why don't we think of all of ourselves as having so much in common? Let's call ourselves humanimals rather than humans and animals.
This chat has just been like the briefest but brilliant of tastes of what's inside the book. It's called Humanimal. It's an absolute treat. It's so bright. It's so colourful. It's so immersive. And it teaches you so much about how we're alike. Christopher Lloyd, the author, thank you so much for coming on to tell us more.
Great pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
This week's Dangerous Dan is all about a disease that has stumped scientists throughout history. Encephalitis lethargica. It's an inflammation of the brain which causes a whole confusing range of symptoms and bizarre behaviour. Everything from hysteria, seizures, and also sometimes people fall asleep. They simply freeze whatever they're doing, and they stay like that for hours, sometimes for days, sometimes even they fall asleep. And that could be the end. They would still be conscious, it's not a proper sleep, they'd still be aware of what's going on, but they're not fully awake, you know, they're not tuned in, they're just statues still, they don't do anything. They're a bit like a lazy zombie. Now, towards the end of the First World War, from 1915 to 1925, around 5 million people across the whole world came down with the disease. And no one knows why. No one knows why suddenly 5 million people across the planet got this disorder. And around a third of the sufferers then died. Those who woke up again had a much higher chance of getting further brain diseases like Parkinson's when they got older. Now, there hasn't been a recorded case of this for ages, and scientists still don't know what properly caused it, why people sometimes fell asleep and then never woke up again. We're covering all sorts of things on the show this week, everything from strange brain diseases to how things are made to light bulbs to rockets. And right now we're moving on to weather with Marina Ventura.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers.
Hi there, Marina Ventura here. I love finding out about the natural world, and that includes the Earth's climate. We know that weather can change from one day to the next, but climates can change too over the time span of years, centuries, or even longer. So I'm on a mission to fill MapApp with the latest climate information with the help of some awesome climate explorers. Come on then, let's go. I bet your parents tell you that fresh air's good for you, right? Especially if you've been indoors for a long time. A nice, big, deep breath of air can certainly feel refreshing. The air around us is all part of the atmosphere, and without it, there wouldn't be any life on Earth at all.
That's right, Marina. The Earth's atmosphere is made up of layers of gases. These include nitrogen, a gas which is harmless to humans, and oxygen, which almost all life needs to live. It also contains gases like carbon dioxide, which trap the sun's heat and help keep the planet warm enough for life, a bit like a blanket. You've probably heard of something called the greenhouse effect. It's another way to describe the effect that the blanket of gases has. Without the greenhouse effect, the Earth would be, on average, more than 30 degrees colder than it is today. Way too cold for life to survive. Brrr. Gases that help trap the heat are called greenhouse gases. But scientists studying the atmosphere have shown that some human activities, such as burning fossil fuels or chopping down rainforests, are increasing the amount of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, which is causing the climate to change.
Luckily, there are climate explorers like Hannah to help us find out more. Let's say hello.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I'm an atmospheric scientist. My work is all about developing and looking after instruments that help monitor different things in our atmosphere. Me and my measuring instruments fly up to 10 kilometers high in the sky on board a special aircraft that takes measurements up in the clouds. The instruments are fitted to both the plane's body as well as its wings and include lasers that measure clouds, small particles and fog.
A special laboratory in the air sounds really cool. So what do you measure?
Well as temperature, we also measure humidity, that's how much water vapour there is, and turbulence and wind, that's all to do with how quickly or slowly the atmosphere is moving around. We can also measure tiny particles like smoke and dust, and even check the level of electricity in the air, something which is connected to thunderstorms.
So what do you do with all the information you collect?
It's used in lots of ways, but it can be really helpful for learning about changes to our climate. The measurements we collect are used by scientists across the world to learn as much as possible about our atmosphere today and what effects humans are having on it. And with the data collected over many years, scientists can use the information to help see changes over time and predict what might happen in the future.
Sounds amazing, Hannah. And that plane full of gadgets sounds like a lot of fun. And what a great way to see the effect of changes in our climate. Ready for upload, Mappy?
Load me up.
Next time, we'll be back on dry land, or should I say muddy land, finding out more about how studying the Earth can help us learn more about the Earth's climate. See you soon.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world. Find out more at funkidslive.com/marina.
Let's have a look at some of the science that you might have missed in your news this week. A grey seal that's rescued on the North Sea coast in England, on the east of the country, is the 50th to be treated by a wildlife centre for injuries made by man-made rubbish. The male animal, named Scylla, was found with an infected wound around his neck caused by a fishing net that got wrapped around and then lodged just under his face. It's terrible news. The RSPCA Centre in Norfolk said that 2019 could be a record year for seal rescues, but for all the wrong reasons. Also, scientists have said that even though the ozone layer over Antarctica is recovering, it can't be taken for granted and it needs to be watched constantly. One of the first scientists who highlighted the thinning of the protective gas layer 30 years ago, Dr. Jonathan Shanklin, said that it's welcome, but it's not the norm. In fact, it's probably an anomaly that we shouldn't get used to. And finally, space scientists in Europe are looking to make a new weather satellite. This one is different as it will monitor the sun for different types of energetic outbursts that will interfere with life down here on Earth. The powerful eruptions of particles and magnetic fields can knock off power grids, stop communications down here, and hopefully by tracking the space weather, we'll get a better warning for when it's going to happen. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. If you've heard anything on the show today that you're not quite sure about, maybe you don't really trust, you don't believe it, well, I can help you out there. If you've got a sciencey question that you really want answered, you need to send it over to me as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. It's so easy. When you find the show on there, there's a little comment box at the bottom. That's where you leave your question. Also, drop us 5 stars. It'll help me see it. And there's a little thing at the top where you can leave your name. Do that as well so I know who to give a shout out to. Also, while you're on the Apple Podcast Store, it's a brilliant place for you to hear all the amazing science things that we do here on Fun Kids. You've heard some today. We've got loads more there. They're on Spotify. They're on Google Podcasts. They're on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com as well. And Fun Kids, we're a children's radio station from the UK. I'd love you to have a listen so we can chat to each other in the week as well. You can find us on your DAB digital radio across the country. We're also on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com.